Support for WKAR is provided by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It is Thursday, February 7th. Michigan Governor Rick Snyder made it official yesterday. He supports expanding the state's Medicaid program. He says covering more people is just a start.
This is about covering people. Now it's incumbent on us to cover them efficiently in terms of better care at a lower cost.
And the Federal Affordable Care Act offers to cover the costs of all the newly insured for 3 years. That's estimated to be close to a 500,000 Michigan residents. Proponents cite the savings to hospitals for no longer having to eat the emergency room costs of treating the poor who can't pay. Currently, those costs are passed along to the hospital's other paying customers. But unlike the governor, other Michigan Republicans are either wary or out-and-out opposed to Medicaid expansion. Among other concerns, they fear the federal government may renege on its offer to pay and that there may not be enough physicians to care for the newly insured population. Current State speaks with a proponent of Medicaid expansion. We welcome David Seaman of the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, along with State Senator Rick Jones. The senator says Michigan needs to improve mental health coverage, but says he is leery of Medicaid expansion. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Mark. Great to
Hello.
Be here.
Hello.
Before we review this issue, I've got to hijack this right out of the chute, because it is, as WKAR reported this morning, the governor apparently will be calling for an increase in education funding in Michigan. Senator Jones, where do you stand on that?
I'm right on board. You know, I've been an advocate for not cutting K-12 and better funding for pre-K, because that's where we get the best bang for our buck. In the early childhood education, if we can get the children ready to go to school, they test out with a higher IQ. They're less likely to get into trouble, more likely to complete their education and get a good job.
Okay. And the percentages, you're okay with the percentage increase? Was it 2%, I heard?
I'll hear that officially today, that it's predicted to be 2%. I would like it to be more. I have been a strong advocate for taking the school aid fund and keeping it in K-12 and pre-K. You know, under a prior governor, it was moved out of the school aid fund, away from the K-12, to community colleges, then back out of there legally and put into the general fund. I'm strongly opposed to that, and I have been opposed for 8 years.
Let's get back to Medicaid expansion, and let's review the basics here briefly, if we can. First, from an advocate's point of view, David Seaman, why is Medicaid expansion in Michigan a good idea?
Well, candidly, it's a really simple issue, and I think it is, Mark. It saves lives and saves dollars. The option under the Affordable Care Act is for a state to accept payments from the federal government to cover people that live below 138% of the federal poverty level. In the state of Michigan, that's estimated to be 470,000 individuals. And we're talking in large cases about working families, people that don't enjoy the benefit of having employer-sponsored health care. They contribute to our tax base, but they don't enjoy the fruits of their labor in terms of having health care benefits. This would allow the state to receive federal fund to pay 100% of their costs for 3 years, and 90% of the costs beyond that. This is a great social policy, and it's a very sound fiscal policy for the state of Michigan, and we should do it.
And are you willing to concede either any disadvantage to expansion or conversely, any advantage to not expanding?
The only argument that we hear that has any potential legitimacy behind it is, you know, experiences in the past where perhaps the federal government has found it hard to continue its support. But the governor has announced that we will save $200 million a year, and that is fairly well thought through. We'll save $200 million a year during these first 3 years, $100 million of which he would put aside in a lockbox to continue it. So the fear that the state would not have the general fund to continue this program after we drop down to 90% funding, the numbers are predicted that we would not spend any additional general fund in this state till 2035.
Senator Rick Jones, clarify where you're at right now. I know a lot of legislators are just kind of getting their head around this. The governor is just officially on the record. Where are you at in your decision-making process on this?
I haven't decided. I want to approach this with caution. I'm told that if we accept this money, the federal government will have total control. And in 3 years, we'll have to come up with $300 million. Possibly in 10, a great deal of more. That's what I was told yesterday as when I inquired. We have another senator who has a group that's studying what if we developed our own plan. For $150 a month, we could provide a great deal of care for these folks. Now, let's remember, we called them families earlier, but we're talking adults. This is not children. This is single people and couples that don't have coverage currently. So that's what we're looking at. Now, what if we supported it ourselves? Could this be a more frugal way of doing it? And we could ask them to have a copay. It's a common term out there, skin in the game. Maybe we need to ask folks to pay a portion. It could start out very, very cheaply, perhaps $20 a month. But when people help pay for their care, they're more involved. They understand. You know, this is the way to put them back on their feet.
Dave Seaman, any response to that?
I guess my response would quickly be we have programs in this state that are actually considered to be quite affordable health care programs. The My Child program stands out. Families can insure their children for $10 a month. We have tens of thousands of Michigan children who are still uninsured because their families either can't or have chosen not to pay $10 a month to insure their children. So the idea of creating yet a different affordable program, I don't think so. I think our fear is we'll be stuck right where we are now, hospitals and other providers in the state shouldering the burden of $1 billion a year in hospitals alone of uncompensated care. This is an opportunity to change that and turn our position as a donor state into one where we get more of a fair share of our federal dollars. Because if we don't do this, remember, other states, including five other Republican governors, have accepted this program already. And if we don't take our money and take care of our families, what we'll find is those dollars will be used elsewhere.
Anything else you want to add there, Senator?
Well, I can tell you that I've studied that. I've talked with the working poor. Give you an example. I had a waitress tell me, my son was bit up by the neighbor's dog. The neighbor's dog had no insurance. And it cost me $800 at the hospital, and I'm going to be paying that on time. And I said, well, your income level can't be great. You're a single mom. You have three children. Why haven't you signed up for Medicaid? Well, I don't feel like it. You know, I don't know how you help people that don't feel like getting coverage. The coverage is there. She could easily pay the $10. We need people to take responsibility to help them. Let's give them a hand up, not a hand out.
Anything to what Senator Jones is saying there? Or would we just rehash what we've already put on the table here, Dave Seaman?
We might. I mean, obviously people come at this from very different political perspectives and certainly from personal responsibility. We share the senator's perception. Yes, we do have to have greater personal responsibility. Again, as we look at this is a program that will instantly save lives and save dollars.
The biggest concern I've read about, and you acknowledge this in your opening answer, David Seaman, is that the federal government may have to renege on its funding in a few years. Why you regard that as a legitimate concern?
I don't know if I regard it as a legitimate concern. It's a stated concern. Obviously, we have seen programs where there's been...
Why isn't it a legitimate concern?
I think that, you know, obviously the Affordable Care Act, as long as this remains the law of the land, Congress will be moving forward trying to maintain services. And again, I think all believe that once you have a program in place and the take-up rate is high, we will save money. The reality is we believe over the long term, over those first 3 years, we'll have people getting the right care at the right time. We'll start to save money. The cost of health care will go down when people get the right care at the right time. What is not happening now? People aren't getting screenings. They're not getting immunizations. They're not seeing primary care physicians. They're becoming ill. When they show up acutely ill in a hospital emergency room where monies are spent very quickly. If we can start to get people receiving the right care at the right time, we will begin to save money, monies that will be available later on to continue coverage.
Any response, Senator Jones?
Well, it is a legitimate concern that the federal government will renege. The federal government changes constantly. We were using a certain type of tax here in Michigan to capture money to help pay for Medicaid. 4 years later, the federal government said, sorry, you can't use that kind of tax. You've got to change. So we constantly have this evolving federal government, and we never know where they're going to be at. So I want to make sure everybody understands I support more care. I am very much want to see better mental health. I don't think we have a good mental health provision here. I want to see more. And so I think we're in agreement on much of this. I'm just urging caution. Let's do it right.
We're talking with David Seaman of the Michigan Hospital Health and Hospital Association, the executive vice president of that group and an advocate of expanding Medicare, and Senator Rick Jones, who is on the fence right now and taking some time to explore what this means. Rick Jones has Governor Snyder's official on-the-record support of Medicaid expansion. Impacted your decision-making process in any way?
Well, certainly when the governor of the state says this is the direction I want to go, I think there's going to be a lot more support. But again, I think the senators I've talked to say let's use caution and make sure we do this right.
Another common concern, Dave Seaman, is the supply of physicians. But I guess studies that you believe are quite credible claim the system can absorb all these new patients, correct?
There was a study that recently came out from the Center for Healthcare Transformation that says, yes, the studies they've done have indicated that services are available. I mean, primary practitioners are available. People don't get care when there's no coverage. It is very hard to find a primary care physician who can afford to take charity services on. They're already providing a fair amount of that. Most people that do have coverage do find their way through, and at least they find their way through federally qualified health centers for primary care clinics and the like, and they obviously also have outreach through community hospital programs.
Senator Jones, what about your fellow House Republicans? How many of them do you think will side with the governor, and how many, you alluded earlier to some other legislation that belongs to Senator Bruce Caswell, correct?
Correct.
Okay, Hillsdale County. How many do you think will side with the governor? How many are following the lead of Senator Caswell in openly opposing this?
You know, I haven't heard of anybody openly opposing, but there are a lot of...
Well, Senator Caswell openly opposes it, doesn't he?
Well, not really. He wants to come up with an alternative plan.
Oh, okay.
So he's not saying don't cover these adults. Find a way to do it frugally. Get the best dollar, you know, the best bang for the buck. How can I predict where the House Republicans are going to be? I can tell you from the ones I've heard that they want to study it. They're willing to study the plan. They're not saying no automatically.
Okay. Dave Seaman, compliance and the time and energy and cost assigned to compliance must be some kind of an issue for your members.
Yeah, it always has been, yeah. And always will be.
I read this morning the Obama administration itself estimates 127 million hours a year will be spent on compliance by families and health care providers. That's without any further rules or regulations. And for all I know, Americans spend that many hours addressing hangnails. I really have no context for assessing that number. I don't know what it means. Can you help our listeners put that number into some kind of earthly context here? 127 million hours, but it's a national act. I don't know if that's right. If that's just really burdensome level of compliance or if it's actually reasonable.
We have an incredible burdensome compliance on from every payer, whether it be a commercial payer, Medicare, state Medicaid. Compliance has always been a complicated fact in this country. Obviously, it's an issue of balancing safety against and fraud and all of those other things that people are trying to protect against. It's very difficult to determine, and I don't know where they come up with numbers of that nature. It is a high compliance industry, and it's because people want to be safe and they want to make sure that the services they receive are fair and of a quality level.
I wish we had more time. We're already out of time. We could go for a while further. We want to thank Senator Rick Jones for coming in this morning and Executive Vice President of the Michigan Health and Hospital Association, David Seaman. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
College football fiends across the land are absorbing and dissecting and slicing and dicing the results of National Signing Day, and WKAR Sports Talk contributor Jack Ebling joins us to explain it all. How are you, Jack Ebling?
Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm fine this morning. All the coaches appear to be putting a positive spin on all their signees, D'Antonio, Hoke, Meyer, everybody. Is any one of them secretly disappointed in their outcomes?
I would buy dinner for the first one who would publicly say, you know, we didn't have a very good year.
Let's focus on Michigan State and Michigan here.
Sure.
Should Mark D'Antonio and the program be satisfied, as he appeared to be yesterday?
Well, I don't think you're ever really satisfied, Mark, but I think that they did fill some needs. They had to find a place kicker. They got a guy who was ranked number one in the country in that category, and I think they got a quarterback of the future, a guy who's going to be a very solid player for them, and Damian Terry. We talked about like Geiger. We talked about some of the other players at important positions, running back being one with Le'Veon Bell leaving. They got three guys who are going to come in and contest for that opportunity. So I think they did fill some needs, and they only have 18 scholarships available, which is good and bad. It means you're going to have a small class. It also means you have some pretty good players still on campus.
What about Ann Arbor and Brady Hoke?
Well, Michigan should always have a great year, and it appears they did. They're ranked in the top 10 and as high as number 2 on some scouting services, just behind Ohio State. So Brady Hoke has it going in Ann Arbor in terms of bringing in top prospects. I just caution people that sometimes there's a difference between top prospects and top players. And Michigan has had a top class in just about every year. They also have lost 5 games or more in 4 of the last 5 seasons. So sometimes there's not a direct correlation between recruiting success and your performance on the scoreboard.
Can you say which program made out better yesterday?
Well, you would think that if you look at where these players are rated, that Michigan got a lot of great linemen. You would think that they would do better, but Michigan almost always does better. I think you can count on one hand in the last 25 years the number of times that Michigan State would have out-recruited Michigan, and yet it's done fairly well on the field, believe it or not. So,
and it sounds like Michigan State loaded up on skill players, it appears.
Yes. And I think that it's really a matter of your needs. You have to wait about 3 years, Mark, to figure out how you did in recruiting, and you don't know which players are going to get injured. You don't know which players are going to develop. Michigan State has done a pretty good job under Mark D'Antonio of finding players who are a little bit off the radar and then developing them. And recruiting to their system, not to what some recruiting analyst says or what some star system holds. But you can't take away the fact that Michigan has a great product to sell, and Brady Hoke and his staff have done an outstanding job of doing just that.
How has Urban Meyer's arrival in Columbus changed recruiting in the rest of the conference?
Yeah, it's really ratcheted it up, Mark. I think you see now that Recruiting there is taken much more seriously, and Ohio State is recruiting nationally. Under Jim Tressel, they put a fence around the state of Ohio and cherry-picked elsewhere nationally. Urban Meyer is truly doing a national job of recruiting and got a couple players yesterday that just really cemented what was going to be an outstanding class anyway. But Ohio State and Michigan, and you can name the schools that are going to be up there every year. They have tradition. They have tremendous stadiums, facilities to sell. They have the hype. They have the Heismans. They have everything you would want to recruit successfully. And they also have great coaches with personalities. And so it's a very tough thing to say no to.
Well, Meyer has apparently ruffled some feathers in the conference as well. What's that all about? How does he go about it differently? Is he just a more aggressive recruiter or what?
A little bit more aggressive. And, Mark, when somebody committed in the past, there was almost a gentleman's agreement in the Big Ten that other Big Ten schools weren't going to go after him. And Ohio State now says, hey, until you sign that letter of intent, we're going to keep up the pressure. And that's pretty traditional in the Southeastern Conference. That's the way it is down there. It's a blood sport. And up here, it hadn't been that way. But now I think you're going to see a lot more schools doing that. Certainly when there was a coaching change at Wisconsin, every school in the conference took a good look at Wisconsin's commitments. And Ohio State just does that 365 days a year.
Do you think that Mark D'Antonio and Brady Hoke will be able to ratchet up their game, or are they ratcheting up their recruiting programs as a response to Meyer's approach?
Yeah, Mark, I think that Brady Hoke has already done that, and Michigan and Ohio State, fairly parallel programs in terms of what they have to offer. Michigan State, maybe at a little different level, has had to go about it a different way. I don't think Michigan State is going to win a lot of head-to-head battles with Ohio State. Probably not in the state of Ohio. If an Ohio kid who's grown up dreaming of playing for the spell and gray his whole life gets a chance to play for the Buckeyes, he's probably going to do that. But as Jim Tressel once told me, there were 54 championship-caliber high school football players in the state of Ohio, capable of winning a Big Ten championship. And the Buckeyes were going to take 12 of them. So that left 40 guys, 42 players available for everyone else, Michigan, Notre Dame, Penn State, Pitt, you name it. They were all coming into the state of Ohio, and you couldn't tell at age 17 who was going to be a star at age 22.
Where does Mark D'Antonio really connect in terms of recruiting, geographically?
Well, geographically, he really recruits the state of Ohio well. And Michigan and Ohio, he considers almost one state. What Michigan State is selling is opportunity and a great family environment, kind of values that Mark D'Antonio holds dear. They can't sell national championships. They can't sell trips to the Rose Bowl. But they can certainly sell a great collegiate experience and a lot of success. It might be easy to overlook after the past season, but this last run of 5 years is about as successful as any in Michigan State history.
We got under a minute left here, Jack. Anything to say regarding the other big programs in the upper Midwest? Notre Dame, Central Michigan?
Yeah, Notre Dame, outstanding year recruiting. Maybe it's best in quite a while. Definitely playing off the fervor for the undefeated season and the bid into the national championship game. And I would expect that the Fighting Irish are going to maintain that lofty position they held this year for some time.
WKAR Sports Talk contributor Jack Ebling. Jack, a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
Coming up, we've got the backstory on one of the most visible, recognizable murals in mid-Michigan. It's on the west side of Lansing, and it features a number of notable African-American legends. We'll have the story coming up on the second half of Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. You can reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. Well, we're starting a new recurring segment today on Current State. It's called the Public Poetry Announcement. We've partnered with the Center for Poetry here at MSU's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities to find the funniest, the darkest, the most heartwarming, even the most heartbreaking poetry out there. And please note, this is not the kind of stodgy poetry you learned in your high school English class that scared you away forever, but it's also not your neighbor's rhymes about sunsets and puppy dogs. The poetry we'll be featuring will be from among the greatest ever written. Now, moving forward, these PPAs, or public poetry announcements, will not be as random as you think. Through their subject matter, or their place in history, or the poet's biographical relevance, these poems will, we hope, add another dimension to the conversations we're already having here on Current State. Sometimes they'll come with a short background about the poet, or a little discussion about the poem, but at other times we'll just let the words speak for themselves. Now, to kick off our public poetry announcements, Current State producer Joe Lindstroth spoke with Stephanie Glazier, the acting director of the RCAH's Center for Poetry, about the often misunderstood art form, and their first featured writer. This is Michigan poet Robert Hayden, who was the first Black poet laureate in U.S. history. The conversation began with a simple question. Why should anyone care about poetry?
Poetry is a wonderful way to belong to a community. I think that's the first thing I have to say about it. It gets people in rooms together. Even now, talking on the radio, this is sort of a way to be in community with people, right? It's a very finely wrought way to say the deepest part of ourselves, and that's a kind of sharing I think our culture often lacks.
You know, poetry has this reputation as being boring, hard to understand. I mean, I'm trying to hurry up because I think people are probably already looking to hit the preset button on their classic rock station.
Sure.
With that word poetry.
Yeah.
You know, people think it's this old, semantic gobbledygook.
The joy, you know, has been sapped out of it for a lot of people, Joe. That happens in high school a lot, right? We learn,
yes,
Edgar Allan Poe, and then we're done, right? And we never look back. I understand that wholly. It's just that there's this entire world out there full of funny, contemporary, colloquial, casual poetry that is a joy.
So, I mean, is it where poetry starts being misunderstood is high school English
in the classroom?
Class,
I absolutely, you know, think so, yeah. In the American context, I would say. Abroad, it's much different. Abroad, they have poetry readings on street corners every Friday in Iraq. I have friends who live there. They tell me about that. I'm wildly jealous.
Wow, that's actually an incredible image.
Yeah.
You know, and I think maybe part of this stems from what we're talking about with the high school confusion. There's so many types of poetry. Verse, limericks, sonnets, haikus, these all seem to have rules, you know, which I can wrap my head around. But then you get thrown at me this free verse, you know,
sure,
this free form, where it seems like, you know, anything can be a poem, and the only requirement really is that the author says it is.
I don't think so at all. I don't think so at all. I think poetry serves the unserviceable. So form, we can think about it, you know, if we want to take a sonnet, right? It has 14 lines. There are these rules. It has a particular rhyming pattern. You can put in a sonnet death, right? And when you have something that huge, something that large and difficult to deal with emotionally, it can be useful to have constraints as a writer. I can tell you that. It's good to be able to quantify things sometimes when they're that large a feeling. Free verse is absolutely about voice, I think, more than about sort of the formality of verse, you know, that has sort of specific rules. Personality really can come through there.
So it is personality. I mean, that's what it sounds like. I mean, it's a choice. I think that's really interesting that you say the structure allows some freedom.
Absolutely.
With the poet
it can be freedom.
To take something as big as love or death and give it some frame, give it something to work with.
A way to think about it.
Right, right. But then, yeah, on the other side, maybe another poet says, death is just too amorphous for me to,
sure,
fit into, you know, a sonnet.
Yeah. And then we get somebody like Allen Ginsberg, who writes pages and pages and pages of meditations on things. It's different for everyone. But I think what's important for me, one of the things that's important to understand in coming to poetry as a newcomer to it, is that poets are informed by each other and by a lineage, right? They're not coming out of nowhere, you know, not just anyone can write a good poem, I do want to say that, but it does take careful study. And people who have cultivated voices as poets are coming out of years of study, of a lineage, of other people's voices too.
See, I think people don't understand that it's almost like academia. If you're going to become an expert in a certain part of political science, for example, you need to understand the discussion.
The theory.
And everything that came before it, so you can find your little niche in that discussion.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. People sort of have this conception of poetry, I think because the material with which that art is made is the material we're using right now between you and I. It's language, right? We use it every day. We use it all the time. And it seems disposable, but it's not. It's really very sacred if you take the time to look at it and craft it.
Let's use an example here. You chose Robert Hayden as the first poet we're going to discuss here. And tell us about him.
Robert Hayden is somebody I have a lot of respect for. I also wanted to start this conversation with you off with a Michigan poet. You asked me to think about economic hardship. And in this state at this moment, I think that makes a lot of sense. Hayden didn't grow up with a lot of money. He grew up in Detroit. He was black. He was nearly blind. He wore these great big Coke bottle glasses. He was terrible.
So the photos you see of him,
nearsighted.
I mean,
yes.
They magnify his eyes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've heard stories of, you know, when he taught at U of M, which he did for many years, he studied there as a student as well. He wouldn't drive, such was his vision, that he just took the bus around everywhere. And so his students would see him on the bus. And I love the thought of that.
Yeah, and he's a shorter man, if I understand, and
right.
He's pictured in bow ties and, you know, these big glasses.
Erudite.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And to see him on the city bus, that's an image.
Yeah, it is. He was also the first, what we know now as a poet laureate, but what was called then the consultant of the Library of Congress in poetry. So the name laureate came along a little later in history after Hayden's term. But he was the first African-American poet laureate or consultant
in 1976.
That's right. So he was a pretty incredible trailblazer in the way of poetry, in that he really refused to participate in people trying to pigeonhole his identity. He was a lot of things that people found interesting. He was an academic and a black one at a major institution in the United States at U of M. He was being taken seriously. He was a great poet. He was Baha'i, which is a faith that is not that well-known, I think, in larger American culture. And he just sort of constantly refused being labeled as any of those things. And he said that he was an American poet, and that was very important to him. And he said it and said it and said it until it was true.
But he came up against a lot of resistance.
Absolutely.
Especially in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was obviously the civil rights era, the black nationalism. Within the African-American community, I think, he was a bit ostracized for this stance.
Absolutely. He was operating in what was all but a white world. And he claimed it for his own, and he refused to accept any other narrative. He just refused them. And I'm so impressed by that tenacity.
So he has this sense of not wanting to be labeled anything other than American poet, but yet, ironically, he is well-schooled in history.
Very well-schooled. I mean, what's so beautiful about that sentiment to me is that he is so specifically himself. He was very deeply rooted in black history in this country, very well-versed in it, and was writing about that, writing of those poems.
Malcolm X,
absolutely.
You know, the slavery,
right.
Harriet Tubman.
But he was claiming them as an American narrative, not a black American narrative. They concern you too, reader, right? He wasn't letting anyone off the hook. And it was just such a powerful rhetorical movement on his part. It indicted us all in a way.
So what poem did you bring for us today?
I think this might be his most well-known poem. It's certainly my favorite of his, and it's called Those Winter Sundays. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices?
Yeah, there's a lot packed into those 14 lines.
There's a lot packed in here. You know, the thing that I like most about the poem, what I'm most attracted to about it, is its confessionalism, right? It's kind of a confession of his child self. He resented his father, but these labors of love, right? What did he know as a child of how much, in fact, he was sacrificing for his children?
You can almost get the sense that, you know, growing up, Robert never maybe even heard him say, "I love you."
Yeah. You don't get that impression. I mean, another thing I really love about the poem, Joe, is that it tells the whole story. It doesn't just say, "I'm grateful. I'm grateful now. I didn't know enough to be grateful then." It says, "I was afraid of him. The chronic angers of that house. He was afraid. Yeah. There was trouble there."
Yeah.
He says that too, right? He's telling a whole story. And that's what I mean when I say poetry serves the unserviceable. It's not just one thing. It's all of them, right? He's giving us his whole childhood here in a way in this one morning.
In 14 lines.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
It's talent. Yeah.
Well, I really thank you for joining us and for beginning this partnership with Poetry in Current State on the radio. Stephanie Glazer is the acting director of the Center for Poetry at Michigan State's Residential College in Arts and Humanities.
Thank you.
That was Current State producer Joe Lindstroth introducing our new recurring segment, Public Poetry Announcement. Listen for another PPA sometime next week. Just a few blocks northwest of the Capitol building is Shenora's Beauty and Barber Supply at 829 West Saginaw Street, Lansing. Shenora's was established by its owner, Ora Fuller, 29 years ago today. Now, as you drive past Shenora's in the Genesee neighborhood of older storefronts and modest two-story houses, you can't help but notice something. Shenora's west wall is adorned with a beautiful two-story, 40-foot-wide mural depicting influential and popular African Americans and other figures from recent years. Adjacent to Shenora's is another older, faded two-story mural on the side of a house, also featuring African American leaders and notable figures from earlier decades. Both murals were inspired by Ora Fuller's desire to showcase African American achievement throughout the world to all Lansing citizens. Ora Fuller's niece, Michelle Burks, is co-owner of Shenora's, and WKAR's Peter Wharf spoke with Michelle yesterday about Ora, the Saginaw Street murals, and her years with the store.
I came here in, I think it's 1995. I was 13 years old, and we were the first Black-owned Bar Beauty and Barber Supply on the west side. And she didn't want to just do it like just for Black folks. She wanted everyone to, you know, come in and see too. But the mural on the wall, the murals is like people who made a difference in America, period. You know, the nows of what was going on right now, like Oprah Winfrey, she's a big success and she made a difference in the community and her community and the lives of other people. Martin Luther King, Barack Obama's on there, Beyonce, a little bit of everybody.
It's cold out. Do you mind if we go outside and just look for a couple minutes?
Sure, that's okay.
I promise I won't keep you out very long. We're looking at the more recent of the two murals. There's quite a variety of personalities on here, from sports figures, Tiger Woods, the Williams sisters, and two figures in art and entertainment, Will Smith, and there's Russell Simmons, Def Jam Records.
Michael Jordan, Barack Obama, Condoleezza Rice, Yolanda Adams. Her granddaughter is the one who wrote the poetry on there. Mm-hmm. And then it was Michigan State students that came out and helped paint it this time. The most recent ones on here. So,
nice.
And it's supposed to be for inspirational purposes and people who actually made a difference and is doing something doing something with themselves that, you know, can say, like, I want to be like them when I get older. So that's what that painting is for.
There's a poem entitled I Believe That I Can. Do you mind sharing that with listeners?
I believe that I can. With the strength of a woman and the pride of a man and the courage in my heart, I believe that I can. I will reach for the stars. I will grow and pass. I will follow my leaders until my own path. With the reach of my hand, I will rise. I will stand. I will fight for my chance. I believe that I can. By Shenora Danielle Williams. And that's her granddaughter.
This is a mural on the side of a house next to the shop that's the oldest of the two murals. It's kind of gray tones now. It looks like it's faded a lot.
Yeah, she doesn't want to get rid of it, so I think she wants to just have someone come and repaint it, but don't take the detail out of it or make it look cartoonish, just to keep it back in its original painting. This one is the original one, and this is by Mark Beard, and this was in 1994, I believe this painting was built. We have James Brown, Michael Jackson, Ice-T, and then that's a new one that was just put up there, though, Bernie Mac, because he recently passed.
And our local guy, Magic, on the left.
Right.
he did pretty well for himself.
Yep, and it's Think About Your Future. Yeah, she doesn't want to get rid of this one. That's the only reason why this one hasn't been repainted yet. So if there's any good artists out there that think they can duplicate this exact painting, give us a call. And this is what it's for at the top,
right,
where it says live, hope, diversity, beauty, strength, believe, create, respect, family, community, pride, and love. That's what All of Shenora's is about. It's not just about hair products or any of that, because when you come into the store, you're going to be greeted, and, you know, we have friendly conversations. We're in the community. We grew up in the community, so we're for the community, and we're in small business for business.
Misha, I appreciate your kindness and hospitality. Thanks
Thank
again.
You. Thank you so much, too. I appreciate you coming out here.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf. You are
saying that the MSU Symphony Orchestra's next concert is Friday at Wharton Center. They'll play Beethoven's First Symphony, music from Aaron Copland's Billy the Kid, and The Chairman Dances by John Adams. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with MSU Director of Orchestras Kevin Noe about the program, starting with the Beethoven. It was published in 1801 and was beginning a new era in several ways.
Music had gotten very much started down the road of being about a personal expression of the composer and less about providing a nice evening of music making for people and entertainment. And by that, I don't mean to cheapen it. I mean, I can hardly cheapen the work of the great Mozart. This is like, you know, unparalleled music. But there's a different thing at stake.
He did have to bang it out because he was working for the royalty.
Yeah. And it seems somehow less personal. You know, you feel with Beethoven that I've got to get it right. You just feel that with him. Whereas Mozart, of course, he didn't make mistakes, so maybe that's not a fair comparison. It's right when it flows out of his pen. But you know what I mean? The angst associated behind the notes. There's something changing there.
So now we fast way forward to John Adams and Nixon in China and the Chairman Dances. It almost sounds like a weird dream that a person would have, the description of what's happening in it. Could you kind of tell us what's happening in this particular? It's a very descriptive piece.
Well, I love the scenario is one in which Madame Mao, right, the chairman's wife, shows up to this event and in front of all these people then winds up beginning a foxtrot, and seized with perhaps the passion of seeing his wife do this, the chairman steps out of his own portrait on the wall and begins to foxtrot with her. This idea of like stepping out of a painting becomes, I just think that's an inspired genesis for a piece. And I think had anybody presented me with that scenario, I would have felt compelled to try to write something as well, you know. And I think he did a marvelous job. It's got this wonderful, what is the right word? It's not just propulsive, as so much of his music is. There's an elegance to this piece, and yet there is a just outside the box quality about this thing that I think sums up that scenario perfectly. It's my first time with it, and I absolutely love this piece.
I actually listened to it all the way through for the first time before talking to you, and was really tickled with the ending.
Oh, the ending.
The gramophone.
The ending is just wonderful. The way the sort of he does this by having sandpaper blocks, you know, the old melodious sandpaper in the orchestra.
Right.
He has the sandpaper blocks playing this little like kind of sound at the end, which is very much like an old gramophone. And it, I don't know where he got the idea to have the whole thing just dissolve like that. The typical dream sequence, you know, in art dissolves with just a diminuendo. Diminuendo means me getting softer, right? I find his solution so much more inventive that it dissolves sort of back inside something that may have been recorded long ago, and it has a historical note to it.
Well, and I also read that in their minds they were kind of back dancing together to the gramophone when they were younger.
Right. And you can hear that sound at the end. I think the ending is really inspired and tickling.
I find that minimalism or post-minimalism or whatever kind of wherever around John Adams you want to put minimalism is becoming easier for me to listen to as I get older and actually more delightful. And I'm wondering, is that, what do you think that is?
I think there's two reasons for it, and I think it's historically been proven to be the case. One of them, which is obvious but cannot be overstated, is that the great composers and artists, the great creators of all time, have always been ahead of us. They've always seen where we were headed before we know where we're headed. They see the beginning of the movement, they seize upon it, and they drive that movement. You know, we follow along best we can, and then we suddenly realize later on, oh, Debussy, that's not so weird and so bad. You know, Stravinsky, wow, that's really pleasurable music. They've always been ahead of us. And the other one, of course, is familiarity. It's not our first time hearing minimalism now. Now we've got quite a bit of history. People have become more versed in it. And I think it is starting to become more synonymous with the rhythm of our lives.
So now we get to Billy the Kid by Aaron Copland, which, you know, if you're kind of going to do, for me at least, the comedy and tragedy masks of Aaron Copland's writing that was particularly descriptive of the West, you know, Rodeo is obviously very upbeat. And Billy the Kid is a lot darker, and it also, I like it better for that.
I think that Billy the Kid is the type of character who we have, through movies and writing and et cetera, we have dramatized in certain ways correctly, and in other ways not correctly. He's now become much more of a cartoon than a real person. The Billy the Kid, the gunslinger, yeah, you know, that sort of sounds great until you think about watching your own mother get killed right in front of your eyes and then actually pulling out a knife and stabbing someone in the street when you're just a boy. That's a very different animal. So the idea of being kind of a rebel without a cause, all of us like that, you know? But Billy the Kid was a real person, you know? And I think that Copland said as much as that he was trying to write a piece that was much more on the side of the fictionalized Billy the Kid than on the real person. But he himself couldn't escape the darkness of it, and you can hear it right away. In the opening of the piece, you hear this wonderful vista painting this portrait of the West and the promise that it holds for people unencumbered by, you know, fences and whatever. The world was your destiny, you know. And even as melodic as that music is, the underpinning, what you hear underneath in the cello and the bass, has a long-term sadness to it. It may be a sweet sadness, but you hear the pain. You hear that all is not well. And I think he did a wonderful job of sort of 80% fiction and 20% real Billy the Kid, you know? And I admire it, and I find it in every note. The places I could show you in the orchestration where he's added those little touches that give you, oh, listen to how lovely that is, but underneath there's a little unrest. Well, how did he do that? Well, look at that. Oh, my goodness. And it's so carefully controlled, you know? He's a bit of a manipulator, that guy.
And then when he brings it back at the end, though, after this, you know, episode telling of his life and death, and then it just sort of rolls on, and there's this almost this sense of there's that power and that expansion and that promise and everything, but also a sense of indifference that it's just going to all keep rolling on. It's so big.
Right, and the last chord, which on first listening sounds kind of triumphant, is much more than that. Probably most of the listeners won't be able to call this up by ear, but it has this wonderful E major quality that's just very bright and positive, except that there's this nasty C natural in it that also says that all is not well in Denmark. And he leaves you with that, you know? If you really listen in a very casual way to this piece, it's just sort of lovely. But if you listen beyond that, I think this piece can really get in there and speak to you.
on tomorrow's Current State, Michigan Budget Director John Nixon. That's our show. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.